You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Okay, good afternoon again, and welcome back. In this first session that we just sat through and listened to and participated in, the focus was very much on transport and infrastructure, and I had said that the second panel is really about the other aspects of connectivity. You can call it soft connectivity, if you like, social connectivity. It's about networks between people, institutions, and ideas. I have said to our panelists, our eminent panelists here, that there were topics, we don't work in silos, so there were themes and issues that were discussed in the first panel, that if they feel welcome, they're welcome to come back and discuss those as well. But we really want to talk initially and essentially about people-to-people connectivity. Let me very, very quickly introduce our panelists. I'm not going to read out their very, very expert biographies, but you have those, but very short introductions. So first of all, Ugo Astuto. He's Acting Manager Director for Asia and the Pacific at the EEAS. Thank you very much, Ugo, for coming. Ambassador Orgil Lusantesiren is the ASEM Senior Official at the Mongolian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And he's very closely involved, as you can imagine, in preparations for the Ulaanbaatar 20th Anniversary Summit in July 2016. Mark Ungerheuer has very kindly agreed to come as well. He's Secretary General of the Luxembourg Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and as you know, he's closely involved in preparations for the Foreign Ministers' meeting in Luxembourg in November this year. Great pleasure to welcome Anita Prakash. She's Director General at the Economic Research Institute for ASEAN and East Asia, known as AREA. And she's worked very, very hard and very long on the ASEAN Connectivity Master Plan. So it's a real pleasure to have you here as well, Anita. Thank you for coming from Jakarta. Also from Jakarta, Aris Junaidi, Director of the ASEM Education Secretariat at the Indonesian Ministry of Education and Culture. The ASEM Education Secretariat is a bit of a unique, if you like, institution, and he'll tell us a little bit about that. And last but not least, an expert on tourism, Professor Yasuhiro Watanabe from the GF Oberlin University in Tokyo, also come here all the way from Tokyo for this seminar, and we're really, really pleased to have you here, Professor, as well. Once again, the rules of the game, the panelists know them. 5 minutes for the first response, I will follow up, and then obviously the idea is, as before, to engage all of you in the discussion. Ugo, I'm going to start off with you, and we're really grateful, as I said earlier, that this conference is being organized in cooperation with the External Action Service. Clearly, ASEM is a big part of your Asia agenda, your Asia activities. We're talking a lot, and there were discussions earlier about how we need to give this a new lease of life, turn a new page, make it more credible, more relevant, and not just a talk shop. And I was wondering if you think connectivity is a way of making all those things gel together and come together.
Well, thank you very much. Maybe I should use my...
Please do, yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Shada. Thank you for inviting me at this seminar, and thank you very much for your help in spreading the gospel about ASEM and its merits. I think we should start by acknowledging what we have done so far. I think we have been doing pretty well with ASEM, after all. Now that we are pretty close to the 20th anniversary, I think we can recognize that ASEM has found its place. Something which is demonstrated incidentally by the constant request for enlargement that we get, and by the attention that it draws from the civil society, from think tanks. Why so? I think we should have a look at the assets, at the comparative advantage that ASEM has acquired in the past 20 years or so. And if I may try to identify this comparative advantage, I think the fact of being such an informal, such an agile framework that has worked, that has helped a lot. ASEM has proved to be a sort of a facilitator, an incubator of ideas, a place where leaders, ministers, or officials can meet, can exchange ideas in a pretty in a pretty informal way, and then brings these ideas elsewhere. So it has also acted as a disseminator of ideas. The concept of bringing together Asia and Europe originally 20 years ago, well, that was quite innovative, I believe, and it's proving its worth now. Can we do better? Well, I'm sure we can. That's why we are now in the process of facilitating this reflection about the future of ASEM, the 20th anniversary, obviously the perfect opportunity to do so. And that's where, I mean, we have also asked an outside view on that, to by think tank, by the commentators, events like this one, and I think the success of this event is telling. What we get, when you said at the beginning, just a talking shop. So, well, I think the effect, I mean, probably it's my background as a diplomat and a new diplomat on top of that, but I think the very fact of having a constant dialogue and open conversation is positive, is not something one should understate. Then in parallel with that, we have also, in the past few years, we have seen a flurry of initiatives of a more technical nature taking place. I think I will refer to the Riga meetings, ministerial meetings, which have taken place recently. I suspect you mentioned that in the previous session. And the number of technical seminars which are taking event, some of which also organized by the European Union. There is one on food standards in the making. Connectivity. ASEM itself, the idea of ASEM itself is about connectivity. Since connectivity, I think we all agree it's a broad concept. I mean, the physical infrastructure is one, people-to-people contact is another. And there in the European Union, inevitably, I think we have an expertise, and that's the very history of the building of the European Union is a history about connectivity, starting with the common market, then the single market, and then the new frontiers, so the Schengen Agreement. When I started my professional career, that was the talk of the town, and now the energy union and beyond, the Schengen space. Connectivity is a buzzword now in Asia. Yeah, you find it everywhere, be it ASEAN. I see many friends from ASEAN, be it in our relationship, the EU-China relationship. It's something, obviously, which deserves to be explored in its all various facets, and I suspect it's going to become a permanent fixture also in our discussion in ASEAN. So if the question is connectivity going to play a role in the future discussion in ASEAN, the short answer is yes, obviously, with a particular added value which is offered by ASEM, which is free-flowing discussion. It's not an institution. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hugo. You said something, I think, which is what a number of people would totally agree with, is that it's a facilitator of ideas, and then those ideas are taken elsewhere for fruition, if you like. In the sense of connectivity, you think that it's the private sector that will then have to pick up the baton, if you like, and run with it?
Well, the fact is the concept of connectivity is so broad that it has space, actually, for all players. The private sector has a prominent place to play. Then we have contacts government to government, or we have discussion in multilateral setting. I mentioned ASEAN earlier, where we have got the master plan on connectivity, and I think we have with the as today, one of those particularly involved on that. And then we've got, for instance, our discussion between the European Union and China, where we are discussing about the possibility to set up a connectivity platform. So I think all of these players are relevant when it comes to connectivity, including individuals in a way, when you simply look at the people-to-people connectivity, which can be translated in very simple terms, also simply in scholarship. And here you've got the experience of the European Erasmus program.
Thank you very much, Hugo. We'll come back to some of those issues. Pleasure now to turn to Orgil. I have to say, Ambassador, quite impressed with how Mongolia is already very actively anticipating and working ahead on the Ulaanbaatar summit. You obviously have high hopes. What are these high hopes?
Thank you. Well, certainly 20th anniversary for an international institution is not a great span of time to assess the failures or achievements. But anyway, 20th anniversary certainly will be a milestone, a major important events as we celebrate 20th anniversary next year. And I must say that my government is fully preparing for the event, and preparations are in full swing. And as Magoli, as chair, we are heading a working group on the 20th anniversary celebrations. And tomorrow we will be discussing how we get to this issue. And there were proposals that we approach to the 20th anniversary celebration in a two-part approach. One is celebration activities, and another will be substantial things. The celebration activities, I think, will help to raise also the public awareness of the ASEM process in each individual member countries, and also worldwide, and in particular in both continents. As far as the substantial part is concerned, we are proposing that along the chair statement, we also issue a document very much in particular a similarity to Helsinki Declaration that was issued on the 10th anniversary of ASEM. So on the 20th anniversary of ASEM, we would propose that we issue Ulaanbaatar Declaration, which would basically assess the last 20 years of ASEM and try to project next decade. And that will be, I think, a very important document, and it has enough raw materials by this time to brew this document. We have Bangkok initiatives from the seminar that was held last spring, and this seminar as well, and also a marvelous study that was commissioned by the Europeans, European Union, that we will be discussing for the next few years. So, months. And again, we are very excited. Mongolia was basically on the news, international news, basically because of mining and history. So, for a small country, for us, it's of course a big challenge to host such an international big gathering. So, all of us, we are happily working on this.
A small, big country is what you are, really. Yeah. And also a relatively new member of ASEM. So do you think, Orgil, that Mongolia has a special role as a connector, as a hub, as a future hub?
Well, when the news reached the Mongolian population, Mongolian public, that Mongolia will be hosting this big event, there have been a lot of excitement and a lot of news in the country. And so historically, if we look historically, certainly Mongolia was an important bridge, an important connector between Asia and Europe. And during the previous session, there was mentioning of Marco Polo. So Marco Polo came to Mongolia during the Kublai Khan. Well, he came to Yuan dynasty, but was ruled by the grandson of Genghis Khan. And during the same period, another Ilhan period in the Middle East, in Iran, another grandson of Genghis Khan, Hulegu, was there. And it's interesting that, you know, during that time, Mongols borrowed the concept of paper money from China and introduced it in Iran. And it was a very interesting... So there are many historical references that we can talk about it. I remember in 2009, at some international conference, Mario Monti, who was Italian prime minister, actually said that it was during the Mongol period that the first free trade agreement was established. So we are sort of going back to our roots. Obviously in a very different historical settings. We are physical connection between China and Russia. Trans-Mongolian, Trans-Siberian railway goes through us, and we are expanding it. We're trying to do our utmost to increase that capability. These days, a lot of and air freight traffic also goes through Mongolian airspace. And there is a lot of, again, soft and hard connections between the two continents that we can contribute to. But in conclusion, I wanted to say that if we look back into the last 20 years of ASEM, there is a much more degree of connectivity that the both people of both continents are enjoying. And that's pretty much credit to ASEM despite all the critics about the process. Thank you.
You're absolutely right, Orgil, and thank you for bringing history in. I think history looms large. Now, one of the interesting things about ASEM today is what Orgil pointed to is that the multitude of seminars, conferences, roundtables, papers, studies, publications that are being disseminated, being done across Asia and Europe on reviving ASEM. The 20th century looms large ahead. And one of them is going to be also what happens in Luxembourg, the meeting of foreign ministers of ASEM in Luxembourg. And that's why it's very important that Mark is here and can tell us a little bit about what you, Mark, in Luxembourg, want to achieve at this foreign ministers meeting as a kind of a stepping stone towards this milestone, which is Ulaanbaatar.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, first of all, I wanted to say that the ASEAN Foreign Ministers meeting will have the title Working Together for Sustainable and Secure Future. But besides, I would say the typical points on the agenda, like international issues, climate change, a few weeks before COP21, we will also speak on the future of ASEAN, preparation of the next summit in Mongolia, and, of course, of connectivity. Well, why connectivity? Because, and it has been many times said now here today, very often ASEAN is characterized as in just a talking club without a common or specific goal. I just wanted to make a side remark, if you allow me. I think often it's also said it's just good for bilateral meetings where ministers can meet. I, as coming from a small country, we appreciate this very much. It's a very great opportunity for ministers of small countries to meet their counterparts, especially from Asia, from bigger countries. But let's come back. I think it is important that ASEAN has a more specific goal and a more specific vision, I think. And I think connectivity could be this. Why? Connectivity, it has been said, exists already a long time, but actually I think the concept as such has not been really in international fora. It has been in regional fora. The EU, ASEAN, the ASEAN Connectivity Master Plan, ASEAN Plus 3. But it's only actually 2 years ago with the Chinese One Belt, One Road initiative that we were more speaking about it internationally and more between Asia and Europe. So therefore, I think ASEAN could be what I would call the institutional home of connectivity, because there is not yet another institutional home, international institutional home. So both sides have a lot of expertise, know-how, and so I think bringing this expertise and know-how together can really provide some added value. It's also great that in Milano it has already been recognized. There have been very productive meetings, the Riga Transport Ministers meeting, the ASEAN industry dialogue on connectivity. All these meetings have done very much progress. And what we want to do now in Luxembourg is to prepare further the discussion on connectivity so that we could take some really concrete steps in Ulaanbaatar when we will decide about the future of ASEAN. So one thing is first, what is very difficult is the definition of what is connectivity. So now we were speaking before about air, rail, road, sea, energy was mentioned, and of course it's also digital connectivity, it is satellites, obviously. But I think what we also want to focus on in Luxembourg is the people-to-people connectivity. So there's an initiative we took together with ASEF and a great Executive Director Cheng, that is the first ASEM Youth Summit. There we will bring together in Luxembourg 150 young leaders who will come first time together. There will be many ministers, also members of ASEM, foreign ministers who will meet them. And the issue they speak most above will be youth employment. But people to people, I think it's also important to bring together universities, education institutions, research institutions, and business. We are thinking that it could be a good idea to revitalize the Asian-Europe Business Forum. And what we also thinking is, and maybe we cannot yet achieve it in Luxembourg, but it's to open our sessions maybe to business, and why not also, it was a lot spoken, how to finance to international financial institutions. That were some ideas we have.
Those are indeed very interesting ideas, and thank you very much, Mark. I think we will look forward to Luxembourg as setting some of the agenda items for later on. I'm talking about people to people now, to Anita, in fact. Within ASEAN, Anita, that side of connectivity hasn't really taken off, has it? So why would the ASEM, which is a much wider, much bigger, more diverse group, succeed in actually having real connections and networks between people when at a smaller level within 10 countries of ASEAN that hasn't really taken off the ground?
ASEAN community, of course, as most of us here would be knowing, is coming into being on 31st of December 2015. But the thing is that ASEAN community work has been a work in progress so far. The community launch, of course, that is an official date. And the community work will remain in progress even beyond 2015. The people-to-people connectivity is now complete in ASEAN because the community is now coming into place, that would be putting it in a slightly... it remains a work in progress. However, a great deal of progress has been made. That's how we look at it within the region. And if you will consider that from where ASEAN as a region or Southeast Asia as a region started and from to where it has reached in terms of connecting people, connecting countries, connecting trade, and connecting all aspects, you know, economic, socio-cultural, political security. Though, of course, I must add here that the economic community is the most visible one and visible to people outside ASEAN. The other community progresses and achievements are more visible inside, as of now, I mean to say. And in fact, that is where we come in, because it is our job to bring those sort of developments and progress to outside world, including Europe. So it remains a work in progress, the connectivity within ASEAN, but a great deal of progress has been made. And even after 31st December 2015, the work continues to, what we are now calling it officially as the vision beyond 2015. So that's how connectivity is looked at within ASEAN. And in fact, most of the success stories of ASEAN have come out precisely out of such connectivities where trade, production, market, of course, is a different story at this time, but production bases will be becoming common after 31st of December. De facto, they are already common, and institutions, movement of labor, and so on and so forth, and other aspects of services, exchange of services, movement of capital, investment, those are all in place. At various stages of growth, no doubt about it, but they are stapling on their, next chapters and next level of progress onto the work already done so far.
Right.
So that's how we are looking at connectivity within ASEAN.
Right. I do have many other questions on it, but I want to come back to the question of regulatory connectivity that was raised in the first session as well, and you have done quite a lot of work in that within ASEAN and also. So how would that sort of experience, the lessons in ASEAN, be perhaps replicated or transferred, if you like, to ASEAN?
Regulatory connectivity is something which is often talked about, but perhaps not understood enough as to how do you really bring it into practice. What do you really mean when you say regulatory connectivity? As we see it, there is no such connectivity as, you know, which is completely free. You have to have some regulations in place which guide connectivities. Governments and policies have to sort of facilitate connectivity. And it is for this facilitation purpose that you have regulations in place. The problem starts when you have asymmetrical level of regulations, asymmetrical level of demands coming out of such regulations, and that is when regulatory convergence, as we call it, comes into picture. And regulatory coherence is also often used. And this will basically mean that when we say that one must have a seamless movement of people or movement of capital or investment or even businesses, then what we mean is that you put your regulations under review. And when we say regulations, we mean here both Europe and Asia, vis-a-vis each other, and you put it under review. You put your regulations under scanner. You have to put your processes under scanner, and you guillotine some of them. You look at the validity, whether some regulations have outlived their validity, whether some new ones need to be put in place. How do you take help of digital technology in getting regulations and use of regulations in place? And most of all, when you talk about coherence, the process of relieving yourself of unnecessary regulatory burden, which we call it RURB, back home. I mean, that is a very important part of this whole exercise. So it is it's an whole exercise which requires a very institutionalized cooperation and commitment. And for that, the end targets must be put in place, and thereafter the work begins. Mm. So that's how regulatory coherence really emerges. But it is a great tool for seamless movement of people and capital and businesses. Mm.
So something which is still, thank you, Anita, so something which is still a work in progress even inside the EU and in many, many areas. So something that the SOMs have to think about when they think about connectivity tomorrow and the coming days. Thank you very much indeed, Anita. Turn now to Aris. Aris, as I said initially, the ASEAN Education Secretariat is rather unique, a child of ASEAN. I'm just wondering, how is it that in this specific area you guys did decide to come together and work in a more sort of sustained and long-term manner?
Okay, thanks, Ada. Distinguished delegate, first and foremost, I would like to express my sincere appreciation to Friends of Europe and organizing committee for giving the opportunity for me to give a talk about ASEAN education process and connectivity. Please let me explain a brief of the role of the ASEAN Education Secretariat. The main task of the ASEAN Education Secretariat are to organize and coordinate ASEAN education activities adopted at the education ministerial meeting, such as seminar, joint working group, and joint expert meeting and workshop, and also help with preparation for ASEAN education ministerial meeting on education, or we call ASEMI. Currently, we are running the ASEMI 5 just recently in Latvia. And then also senior official meeting 1, senior official meeting 2, and then intermediate senior official meeting and follow-up output-oriented activities. And also the task, another task is to ensure the effective coordination and sustainability projects of ASEAN education process, as well as provide regular update and report to ASEAN members countries on the ASEAN education process, and provide service and distribute information through newsletter, gazette, and also updating our website. In addition to that, the Secretariat also organizes and coordinates activities adopted at the ASEAN Education Ministerial Meeting, provide regular update and report on the ASEAN education to ASEAN members. And the uniqueness of the Secretariat, that the ASEAN Education Secretariat is the first and the only Secretariat of the ASEAN Ministerial Level Cooperation, which was established in 2009 in Bonn, and then the Secretariat moved to Indonesia in 2013 for another four years, so until 2017. As an only Secretariat in ASEAN cooperation and coordinated 53 ASEAN members countries and on education activities, the Secretariat has created its own space for action and share its expertise both inside and outside the ASEAN education process, and further to that by coordinating and distributing information in regard to the ASEAN education process, the Secretariat has created information transparency to enhance and to sustain the relationship and cooperation and the fit of education between member countries and also stakeholders. The Secretariat also stimulate member countries to actively participate in the ASEAN education process. In this context, it is believed that ASEAN Education Secretariat could become a role model for ASEAN cooperation in other sectors. Oh, and then please let me brief about the result of the ASEAN meeting in enhancing the activity in education. As I mentioned previously, that the ASME 5 was held recently in Riga, Latvia. The theme of this meeting is ASEAN education collaboration of the research, and this is a very great success. And the four priority on the ASEAN education process, namely quality assurance and recognition, balanced mobility, engagement with the business and industry, and then lifelong learning, including technical vocational education and training. The training was discussed in the 2 days meeting, and the four priorities, as I mentioned before, a process plays in the important role in enhancing connectivity in education through various activities and projects, such as the important thing is ASEAN Bridging Declaration and Recognition and Qualification, and then ASEAN Joint Curriculum Pilot Project in Tourism and Hospitality, and then ASEAN Work Placement Program and ASEAN Working Group on Innovative Competency and Entrepreneurship in Education APS, ASEAN Rector Conference and Student Forum. And then, because the time is limited, so I just give a short and conclusion. So that means by the numerous undergoing of carry out the activities, it can be concluded that the commitment and the connectivity of the people between the ASEAN members country is fairly high. And one of the future expectations is that education cooperation between Asia and Europe will be further developed and promoted to enhance the connectivity. So that's all what we have done in the Secretariat.
Aris, it's very impressive. Thank you very much for that. But I just wanted to know also, in terms of practical achievements / results, do you bring the academic community together? Do you bring students together? Do you agree on certain sort of projects that you do together?
Yes.
So yes. Is that the way it's done? And is it like-minded countries agreeing to work together, or is it the 53 together that have to do things?
Yes, especially from the connectivity in the academic view in the academic community, in this case, is play an important role in enhancing ASEAN education process, because the academic community is participated very actively. Right. In the seminar
so
and
joint group.
Yes, this is very important role because the expertise can be influenced or as a lesson learned from the important program like a joint curriculum and work placement program and dual study program. This must always improve with the student and also in the academics.
Okay, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Professor Watanabe, so Tokyo will soon be hosting actually an ASEM discussion on tourism, and you are a specialist on this very, very booming sector, because a lot of the connectivity work or the reality of connectivity is through tourism. So I was wondering if you could explain how you see tourism as part of this ASEM connections and networks, please.
Okay, thank you, Sada. And first of all, I'd like to thank Friends of Europe and all the organizing committee for having me here to talk to you representing the tourism sector and my country, Japan, and Asia. I'm really honored and really happy to be able to come here and talk to you about tourism, because I kind of had the feeling that ASEM didn't like tourism. But your words were very nice, Sada. Thank you very much. And of course, this topic of this meeting is connectivity, and especially when we talk about people-to-people connectivity, I think you will agree that tourism, one a person living in one place, visiting another and meeting another people, which is the basic of tourism, is one of the very, very important assets of connectivity. I studied, this is the first time to be involved in ASEM meeting for myself, so I studied the activities of ASEM, and I was very pleased to find out that last year in Milan, the leaders of the summit meeting agreed that tourism is one of the important factors in the growth of the nations, as well as bringing people and people to people together. And of course, thank you for mentioning, Sada. That is one of the reasons, one of the main reasons that later this month, in September 25th in Tokyo, Minister of Foreign Affairs, Japan, is hosting ASEM meeting on tourism promotion called ASEM Symposium of on Tourism Promotion. I think this is very in line with the importance of the topics that we are discussing today. Now, I'm the only one talking about tourism.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm very sad, but
unique
sadly.
Unique position.
Thank you. Let me give you a brief aspect of world tourism right now. According to WTO, WTO here is World Tourism Organization, right. Not your WTO. according to UN WTO statistics, last year, more than 1.1 billion people traveled overseas to a foreign country. The technical term is international tourism arrivals, but simply put, more than 1 million people, 1 billion, sorry, people traveled overseas. So that accounts for one out of every seven, approximately seven people living on Earth. This is a very big number. And among these 1.1 billion people, about Europe as a destination accounts for more than half, about 53% of the travelers visited Europe. And also about 23 or 24% of total travelers visited Asia. So when we look at these two figures, Europe and Asia combined, it accounts for about three quarters of all the international travelers in the world. So this is a very... Tourism between Europe and Asia is very, very important. So as we all understand, or as I understand, tourism has very many benefits. Of course, these days, economic benefits is the focus of attention. But apart from that, there are cultural benefits, social benefits, educational benefits. There are many, many other benefits. So it is very important. And it's for us, our life, our community, and our country. And finally, for the global community to promote tourism, especially between Asia and Europe. Because Asia and Europe, as we all know, has very different backgrounds. We have different motivation of tourism is basically in two categories, natural assets and cultural assets. When we look at cultural assets of European countries and Asian countries, and cultural tourism assets of European countries and Asian countries, we notice that they are very, very different. For us, for people, especially the young people, it is very, very important to recognize the difference of the community. So tourism is one of the very important factors that can accomplish this very important connectivity of the people. So that's why, that's one of the reasons again that we, Japan, are hosting a meeting on tourism promotion later this month, and I expect that more and more deep discussions will be held there to promote more tourism, international tourism between Asia and Europe at that meeting. Thank you.
Professor, one very practical question. Well, two actually. One is, what can ASEAN do to increase this? I mean, it's been a topic in ASEAN for some time, but how do you in practice do that? And in a world where we've talked about the obstacles, but there are obstacles in railway routes, but there are obstacles for people moving around. We've seen this now as we speak. So how can those obstacles be overcome if this 1.1 billion people is to turn into 2.2 billion people?
Yes, 2.2 is a little difficult.
Okay.
WTO forecast 1.8 in 2030.
All right.
So, well, we should look at 2.2, I think. The first question, Shada, thank you very much. What can ASEAN do? Like I first said, we have the kind of impression that ASEAN's activity on tourism is, how should I put it? Not really...
modest.
Thank you.
It's modest.
Thank you. I was looking for that word. Like I explained, tourism in 21st century is very, very important activity of people, and it has lots of benefits to community and the people. So I would hope that ASEAN... with time restrictions, I can't go into the details, but I would hope that ASEAN would bring the member countries together and discuss, give the opportunity to discuss tourism promotion in many, many assets. And that includes, like you said, obstacles in tourism, international tourism. I was very interested in listening to the first session, the obstacles in railway transport between Asia and Europe. The gauges are different, so I was very interested. But in international tourism, there are obstacles, and we are discussing, the discussion is very active right now. I think you can name some of the obstacles, the visa obstacle, visa processes, border control processes, and of course these days at the airport, security control, which are all important. But for instance, with visa processes. Of course, people's movement cannot be free. That's too risky. But just we can think of it, I think we can expedite a lot of visa processes. And hopefully, if ASEAN can voice these importances and bring up the people of the staff of this area together to discuss into this field, I think it's a very beneficial movement of ASEAN for the international tourism.
So food for thought for the SOMs and the foreign ministers, Mark, perhaps also something for Luxembourg. Thank you very much indeed for your initial comments and interventions to the panelists. I'm happy now to tell you that we have half an hour or so for questions and answers, and I think a lot of the questions have been, a lot of the interventions have aroused curiosity and merit questions from yourself. So first of all, of course, my old friend, please, could you, one of my colleagues, please bring the roaming microphone here.
Soksapana from Cambodia. Professor, I'm quite interested about your notion of tourism, but I thought that if you look at here, most of us are not tourists. We are, you know, coming to official meeting, but believe me, we are, I would say 25% we are tourists, compliment of our government, you know, to send us to this official meeting. No, what I'm trying to say, Professor, is that, you know, sometimes the statistic cover the tourists who wearing jeans, you know, that sort of thing. But don't forget the delegation tourism. Well, I don't know, maybe I'm introducing a new concept, but delegation tourism is a big thing for the country. Thank you.
Yes, please. Professor, do answer that.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that. Delegation tourism, it is very, very important. And you said 25%, but according to these members, I think that varies, I think. And hopefully, I think 25% goes greater to amount. In tourism, thank you very much anyway. I mentioned about the benefits of tourism, especially the economic benefits of tourism, which is the focus of attention. But when we look at these economic benefits, actually there is no difference between so-called business traveler and leisure traveler. And hopefully, delegation travelers are the biggest spenders, I hope. I'm just joking. But with these, may I just say, delegation, we wish that we could have more of those delegation tourism. Thank you very much.
So the diamond ring for your wife is part of the spin.
That's above my pay grade.
Okay.
But bow tie, okay.
Ah, bow tie is very welcome. Anita, would you like to talk about the tourism aspect of within ASEAN, perhaps, and lessons for ASEAN?
Yes, definitely when we say people-to-people contact, tourism is uppermost on our mind. It is the first and the most prominent face of people-to-people contact. And of course, statistics which were mentioned earlier by Professor Watanabe have very impressive figures for Europe. And Asia also could boast some very interesting statistics on this aspect, including ASEAN countries. I mean, Indonesia, Bali, Bangkok, Phuket, and other hidden treasures, or not so hidden treasures of ASEAN. They have a very impressive number. And one thing is very common, at least in among all the Asian destinations, is that the visa processes have been eased up to a great extent. And as in business, so in tourism, because tourism is ultimately a service industry, businesses always will tell you one thing, that it is the returning customers who bring in the most benefit. The amount of time and effort that you create, that you spend in creating one new customer, you could maintain a minimum of seven customers. I'm sorry, pardon me for using the word customer, but since we are using the analogy of business here, that's why I use that word. So for the same time and effort and resources, you could maintain seven more returning. And it has amazing intangible benefits on the psyche of your opinion building class, your tolerance for situation and in other region, in other country. They grow amazingly out of people-to-people contact. So when crises happen in Europe, Asia is watching it so carefully now. I wonder if this would have been possible earlier. Everybody is concerned as to how Europe is taking care of the refugee problem. And that is precisely because of our openness to this society. We now really... In a manner of speaking, we actually see it as our problem too, because ultimately we are able to see that it is a humane problem. It is not a European problem. And this happens only through people-to-people empathy, and physical contact is definitely the first way of knowing, the touching and feeling. So, yes, easing of processes and visa, of course, is the... And may I also add that ultimately... the business, the diplomatic passports and official passports, no less of the pain, but it is the personal passports, which really have to go through the whole processes. So one should actually be looking at the policy space that is here to improve the people-to-people contact from a personal passport perspective. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Would anyone else on the panel like to come in on these issues? I'm very happy to take a few comments, or we can move on with the questions and you can come back to it later. That seems to be the consensus. Norbert Bass, please. Could you guys please...
Thank you, Norbert Bass. I was ambassador to Indonesia and to ASEAN combined and to South Korea before, so I feel quite connected to the ASEAN area and to the topics ASEAN is discussing now. And I've always believed, as you mentioned, that the EU and ASEAN could be really very good partners in promoting things which then could be introduced or collected or be integrated into the or under the ASEM hub. Now, my question relates to this notion you brought into the discussion, Mr. Ungerheuer, on ASEM becoming the institutional home of connectivity. So, as we all know, government officials and ministers don't like duplication of work. So, do you have sort of criteria when a subject of this wide range, enormous wide range of connectivity fits under the umbrella of ASEM, when it has perhaps even a kind of authentic value being generated in ASEM or through ASEM? Or would you say it doesn't really matter? I mean, we are ready also to collect the fruits of the others, what other organizations produced, and we just place them under ASEM for reasons of visibility or political cooperation or things like that. Hmm. I think it must be not an easy task to make this selection. I mean, so many issues have come up here already. Yeah. I mean, I would think of another 3 or 4 or 5 I could also you know, bring in. But where do you sort of, how do you judge? Thank you.
Thank you, Norbert. Mark?
Well, it's a, not an easy question. No, I think when I thought about institutional home, the idea was that you know, all many issues they are discussed in different international fora. Connectivity, not yet. So I think that, but I thought it more general. Connectivity would be something like a goal and common objective of all the other members. A little bit like when you took APEC in the beginning, there was the big, the issue was economical cooperation, the big free trade area between Asia and the American Pacific Island. So here you would have connectivity, and there we, of course, we have to inspire ourselves from what is done in ASEAN, the ASEAN Connectivity Master Plan. And we have this what I also refer to, the One Belt, One Road initiative of China. And I think we should build on this, but make it, of course, larger. Make it much larger, speaking about tourism, speaking about other things. And I think we have to get also more concrete. We just not should stick to a talking club. I think also it needs insight. It has to be discussed, of course, in the summit, but it has to be discussed also. I think we need another economic ministers meeting once again, because this I would see as a very good place to discuss connectivity. Unfortunately, it hasn't taken place since 2003. That are issues, what I think, how we should tackle connectivity also in institutional way in ASEM, even if the summit, the leaders will keep the guidance.
Mm. Mark, thank you very much indeed for raising the issue of the economic ministers meeting that hasn't been held for 12 years, and high time it is indeed to hold it. Ugo, would you and Orgel, would you and... like to come to this issue that Mark was talking about you know, various aspects of ASEM moving at very different speeds.
Well, when we talk about ASEM, we talk about...
It's on, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Hello. necessary pillars of ASEAN, the political, economic, and the social, cultural, and we often talk about also equality of first.
Take another one. Thanks, Anita.
And then while we look into the past 20 years, then we actually see that you have just mentioned that, for example, this economic ministers meeting haven't taken place for some time. And then how can we talk about pillars being equal and how we balance this? And in this regard, I wanted to draw your attention to the study that was again commissioned by European Union, and there's a couple of very interesting suggestions. For example, engaging a business community more into ASEAN process. And I think while we don't have economic ministers meeting, or while we are waiting for the economic ministers meeting, so engaging more business community from both sides into this process will be at least a partial attempt to rectify the failures that happened. So I stop at this moment.
Yeah, thank you. Ugo?
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Shadak. I guess we'll refer back to the original inspiration of the ASEM idea, where a place where you can have a free-flowing discussion, which is not constrained precisely by an institutional setting. So I would have a different perspective when it comes to to an institutional home. I would rather, again, prefer to see ASEM as a laboratory for ideas, which can then be challenged into the place where, well, you already have got these mechanisms in place that can translate these into, for instance, there was a discussion earlier about regulatory reform. That's certainly not something you do in ASEM. I think that will run counter to the very DNA of the ASEM idea. When it comes to economic ministers meeting, I mean, if we haven't had one for 12 years, there must be a reason. I mean, this is the one point where we have to look at what's the comparative advantage. Again, I think ASEM has been doing well, has been performing well, and I think we have to build on its strength. And rather than stray into fields where we have other institutions actually already at play. That's my view, and I hope it's faithful to the achievements that ASEM can count upon. I mean, what we have done in the past 20 years. Thank you.
I mean, having attended some of these business community meetings, I think more interaction and more real discussion rather than talking past each other would be very welcome. And I think some of the business people who've come to our meeting this morning and now have shown the way this can really be done. So thank you very much. I had a question from the gentleman here. He's been waiting patiently. No, go ahead.
Hello, good evening. I'm Alberto Mattiuzzi, and I work for the European Agency for Small and Medium Enterprises. More than a question, I would like to be a positive contribution to the discussion on interconnectivity, and in concrete saying that interconnectivity to me is also exploitation of synergies, possible synergies, and this I wish to highlight to you the European Enterprise Network initiatives in the area with the enhancement of the business cooperation centers, which is a branch of this network, European network, composed of 600 organizations and more than 4,500 contact points, which provide contacts and direct link for local business both in Europe and in Asian countries, and has a marketing spot for my employer. I just renew the invitation to submit to the missing countries in Asia their application to take part to this network with a cutoff date of end on mid-December. And currently we experience networks and presence in China, India, yeah. Japan, and Indonesia, Taiwan, and we look forward to enhancing the network on concrete B2B events. Mid of October, we will have representatives from these countries coming here in Europe to learn how to enforce and promote business partnership opportunities, either also in research and the technology transfer. Sorry for interruption. Wish it to be just a positive confirmation on the possible synergies that can be exploited.
Thank you. I guess one idea would be, thank you very much indeed for that advertisement, but that was very good, very useful indeed. I think one thing would be to have perhaps an inventory of all the different informal or formal connectivity initiatives that exist out there that we're not very well versed in at the moment. Lei Hui, please. So please, could you give the microphone?
Thank you. I'm Lei Hui from the EU Centre in Singapore. In the earlier session, I think someone mentioned about the cross-sectorial connectivity across sectors. And I want to bring it to this point that we have, of course, a lot of meetings, as pointed out. We have the business forum, the people's forum. But these various forums sort of are on parallel tracks. They do not connect. So when we talk about connectivity, and we know that if you talk, we're going to talk about building roads and whatever. You need to bring businesses together with policymakers. And you talk about people-to-people connectivity. You bring the civil society, the academics. So what I'm asking is, how can we transform this Asia-Europe meeting so that these different the different stakeholders come together across some different sectors? You know, I have written a piece some time ago about using this, transforming this Asia-Europe meeting into more like a mini Davos, where you bring different sectors together on coalesce on certain issues in order to get a more well-rounded and a more comprehensive and better discussions. So I just wonder what the panel think about how can we bring the different sectors, different stakeholders together more, rather than in happening in parallel sessions. You don't talk to each other, and everyone has his own agenda that either repeat or sort of duplicate, and you know, and then just talk past each other.
Yeah, your idea, in fact, Lei Hui's idea was to convert ASEM into an Asia-Europe marketplace of ideas. And I think you're right. It's one of the points that we, as thinking ahead, ASEM rethinking, have been talking about, is how to make it more relevant by bringing everything together. I will leave that question. Yeah, Mark? Please, if you are ready to bring it up. Yes, I'll come
yes,
to you.
Yes, that's. I think it was a little bit this idea, and of course I have read Lewis' paper about the marketplace. I think that was a little bit the idea what I said. I think there where we have no cross-sector connectivity is that the politicians stay on their side, the academics on their side, and the business on their side. And I think we should think about, as we have a traditional ASEM meeting is 1 to 2 days, we should think to open at least one session. I wouldn't go that far than a Davos, but one session to have interaction among the different sectors. I think the Chinese initiative on the working group on connectivity goes a little bit in that way, but I would see it more that there would be a different ASEM meetings, be it education meetings, you would invite more university people, education ministers meeting, and that would be a transport meeting. You would also invite transport business people and things like that. But just one session. Of course, ministers need to also to remain among themselves or have their informal discussion, like Mr. Stutter put it out. Yeah.
Anyone else want to come? Yes, Shanita.
It was mentioned in the earlier session that policymakers do not like duplication of activities. And in fact, in any cooperation or connectivity program, duplication is highly... you cannot totally avoid it, of course, but you can certainly minimize it to the best possible extent. And what I see here as a scope of work, which ASEM may perhaps like to carry to its some meeting, is that a kind of a track 1.5, operation is put in place, where we have done this kind of a work on a different platform, where we have cataloged the whole economic and technical cooperation activities within the 16 member countries of RCEP. And a similar exercise we can undertake under a 1.5 operation, where you catalog and put into place. It also gives a direction to the SOM and policy makers where to put in their focus and so on and so forth. So such cataloging would be
Yeah, absolutely. This, I think one of the ideas Lewy has had is also of an inventory of connectivity, in fact. Thank you very much. I did see another hand go. Oh, yes, I saw Wolfgang and the lady over there. And in fact, Ambassador Zhang, I was going to give you the floor anyway because I apologize. I did not welcome you, especially you are the head of ASEF, of course, and a key player in all the people-to-people connectivity actions that we have been talking about. So with great pleasure, I will ask you now to say a few words. Please, can you bring it forward here?
Thank you, Shara, and thank you for all the panelists for your very useful and interesting contributions. I think this afternoon's conference is very useful. I don't want to talk too much about ASEF's contribution in the area of connectivity, but I think exactly what we are doing is to promote the connectivities, especially the human connectivity, yeah, among the Asian Europe countries, which is the foundation for all the connectivity, all the cooperations. So we will continue to do so. And like Secretary General mentioned, in the youth area, we will launch a series of projects to promote the future connectivity, which will last for years and benefit for the future generation. I think this conference is very useful. I say so because I have the feeling, it seems, after 20 years of ASEM's existence, eventually ASEM members find a common ground, common topics, where we can work together and benefit from it and to reap the common benefits. That is connectivity. I think from the two sessions, we can see there are great convergence on this topic. And all gave a very positive views and comments about the importance and also the contribution that connectivity can make for the future development of Asian-Europe relations. And I think, yes, connectivity is a very relevant, very practical, and is an overarching issue nowadays. It covers all areas from the discussion we can see. So I think if we can follow up with today's discussion with concrete actions and proposals, maybe we can make a great contribution to the foreign ministers' meeting and also to the leaders' meeting, yes, and also to the celebration of 20th anniversary of ASEM process. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador Zhang. And just to reassure the panelists and everyone else as well, this is not just a one-off. This is an ongoing discussion, but also there will be an event report with all the suggestions that you've made. My colleague Sebastian is working on that even as we speak. So there is a follow-up, to be done, and absolutely nothing will be lost in the air. I have a question here. Could I have a show of hands of the number of people who still 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so 5 questions. They'll have to be very short and snappy,
very short,
but I'm happy to take them. Please.
Hi, I'm Ludmila from Brazil, representing ISA's South-to-South Cooperation, and my question has to do with education. Are there specific initiatives and promotion of education for women given the in the sectors that will matter, in other words, in demand-driven sectors, given the disparity in educational level across the Asian and the European countries?
Thank you, Ludmila. I'm going to take a couple of questions together and then turn the floor to panelists. Another lady over there, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Anna Prokupkova. I'm a student at KU Leuven. And I have a question for Mrs. Prakash, especially about Within the ASEAN economic community, there is the free movement of skilled labor. So if there is any platform where the academic degrees are already recognized, or how is that going to be interconnected? And as well, the less developed countries are afraid that their elites and their, because there is already a lack of skilled labor, that they would leave the country and look for better conditions in other countries. So if there are some initiatives that could prevent that, or like to make more trainings, so like on the ASEAN level. Thank you very much. Mm.
Thank you very much indeed. There was a lady there. Did I have any other hands up here? Oh, yes, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, thank you, Sada. I'm Dewi from Indonesian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Actually, I'm also interested to the presentation of Mr. Watanabe about promotion of tourism. And I agree it's very important for us meeting also to discuss on the matter. There are some obstacles already been discussed before, but I think, again, about the connectivity is very important for us to consider how to facilitate the movement of people. We already just previously in the previous session discussed about connectivity, including air transportation. So I think it's very costly for every airline to fly to all over the countries. So I'm thinking of to suggest of exploring more about code sharing cooperation among ASEAN by maybe at first listing what is the condition of the flight for every country and then to see the possibility of connecting by the code sharing. Well, on visa itself, actually, Indonesia at the moment is already exempt visa for 30 countries and soon will be given to 47 countries, including all, European Union as well as Schengen countries. So, I mean, this is one of the way of facilitating the movement of tourism. And we are now also working on with the European Union and Schengen countries for Indonesia to get the same treatment. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Devi. Please, Wolfgang, I'll come to you. Very briefly, please.
Yes. Thank you very much. We had this morning discussion on TTIP, that means the transatlantic FTA negotiations, and I had the feeling that the difference between the USA in terms of standard setting, regulatory cooperation, and Europe are quite deep. And I have sometimes a feeling, after having studied and lived in Asia, that there is much more in common between Asia and Europe in this connection. In very simple terms, in Europe, we have the precautionary principle. Before you throw a product on the market, it has to make sure that it's safe, more or less, which is different from the American approach, where the liberal market just takes the product and there are liability issues in court later on. And I would like to ask the Asian participants here in the panel how far you would have the choice between the two, you would go for one or the other. Thank you.
Okay, loaded question, please. Thanks, Wolfgang.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Xiaoying Liu. I'm a special consultant and innovator and architect from the Netherlands and originally from China. So I would like to bring a maybe still a missing layer here. What is the green connectivity or okay. green economical connectivity?
Yeah.
Yeah. And more importantly, or make it very concretely, people-to-people exchange and don't happen in a vacuum. It always happens in a place, a space, as we are here now in the meeting. And I know that innovation is very difficult because often when people are talking about innovation, and that is not innovation itself. So my question and also a suggestion is that how the connectivity between Europe and Asia will go to take place in schemes and in finance and in the stakeholders, and will they still be kept in a small group of people who know this at all, or it could be spread to a much broader public? The Japanese professor told the number of travelers, but the majority of travelers don't know what we are talking here today, and also the previous talks, and this is a very pity missing chance. Sorry to limit on time.
So, fine.
But we need is maybe not a longer discussion of that because it is difficult to involve everyone.
I need you to get shorter, please. We get your point.
Yeah. We need innovative instrument and interface. We're working on that, and we are now taken up by the EU side and also some Asian side, and for the Eco Innovation Conference. So,
no, thank you very much. Thank you for bringing up very important issues. No, with great pleasure. I'm going to go in reverse order now because the questions have been really very diverse and I have to say very important ones. So, Professor Watanabe, if I could kick off with you. This is the final round, so you have to say everything you want to say. It has to be said now.
I thought so. Okay. Thank you for the question concerning the co-chair flights and the visa processes. Apparently, from the Japanese point of view, abolishment of visa in Indonesia meant a very big business chance for many industries in Japan. So firstly, the co-chair. Co-chair flight, of course, this benefits the airline industry, not necessarily the tourists. So if I may put it in an extreme way. So because of that, I think this is partly or mainly regulated by the government authorities, aviation authorities. So I'm not sure if co-chair, personally, a co-chair would enhance the volume or the quality of the international tourism. But one thing I didn't mention today is the importance of long-haul LCCs. This is a world, low-cost carriers. If you live in Europe, LCC is everyday business, is it? But in Asia, especially in the northeastern Asia, LCC is still new. And especially at this moment, long-haul LCC is not, due to many restrictions, of course, and business restrictions, is not happening yet. But in order to promote Asian-European tourism, I think long-haul LCC is going to be the key word. And as for the visa visa processing, of course, like I said before, movement of people cannot be totally free. So what I mentioned here is that processing can be a lot expedited. For instance, I think you have taken visa before, and of course you have passport. The form you had to fill out to get the visa, isn't that almost similar with the passport form? So, well, this is one of the symbolic things. We can expedite the process of visa, and which will enhance the volume of international travelers. I'm speaking too long.
No, you're fine. Is there any other point you want to make?
Okay. People-to-people movement. Let me just tell you this. We had Fukushima, okay? It's already 4.5 years back now. Still, many people are living in, not very many, people are living in temporary houses. So there are, in Japan, tourism to meet those people, families, living in temporary housing. Tourists are those living in Osaka or Tokyo or many urban areas. And I'll be short, but research shows that the mental status of the, if I may use the word, refugees, were highly, even if temporary, very, very much enhanced. So this is one of the benefits, very important benefits of tourism. So I think this can benefit Asia and Europe too. So this is my final word. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor. Really happy to hear your views on a topic we don't really discuss as much in depth as you've just done in a few minutes, really. Aris, please.
Yeah, thank you. If I'm not mistaken, from the question about the woman, promoting women in the ASEAN education process. So in this several working group or expert meeting, this issue is raised in this meeting. But there is no real, what we call it, real concrete action about this issue. And then I will take this note. And then the next meeting from the working, we call work placement program, the meeting will be in here on the 24th to 25th of September. So I will raise this issue again. And then also I will bring this issue in the several expert meeting. And then brought to the ISOM. intermediate senior official meeting will be next year in Korea. So thank you.
Ludmila, well done. Thank you very much. Anita, please.
I'll take the question which was addressed directly to me on the movement of skilled labor in the ASEAN community. And the short answer, of course, to the question is that no, there is no such fear of losing of skilled labor. Because one thing is, as I mentioned in my previous submission, was that the community building process has been a work in progress for a while. So it's not as if there is a curtain coming down or going up on 31st December there is a kind of a deluge which sets in, which sends skilled labor outside from one country to the other. It's not working in that way. And the other thing is this, that labor movement in ASEAN, both de jure and de facto, has been going on for quite some time. So it's not as if that the ASEAN community would be coming face to face with the issue of movement of labor, both skilled and unskilled, on a particular day. It's been going on for a while, and it's been working very well so far. In terms of institutional arrangement, what ASEAN has in place is the mutual recognition of at least 7 professional degrees, which includes accountancy and architecture, etc. So it is the MRAs which are really being put in place. Not all are in place yet. So it's not as if there would be a mass transfer of skilled labor from one country to the other within ASEAN. But the fact that there is a freer movement of labor within the region, so to say to say that such exchange of labor would be perceived with a negative emotion, that is not quite true. In fact, there is a very positive element prevailing in ASEAN at this time. However, what really needs to be done, I mean, we can put this question in a different way, that perhaps more outreach and more education is required about what ASEAN community will be bringing to the people in terms of its positive contents. And perhaps that is where, which is more by way of communication. That is what is required here. And fear, if any, will actually be addressed through such communication and outreach processes. And I think the policymakers are very mindful of this fact. Unfortunately, the region is still small. Resources are still limited and stretched in the whole community building process. So there has been a bit of a sequential element here that the community building process is on one platform and the outreach has not been running parallel to the community building process, but that is where we also step in and chip in whatever little we can do from our side. So that's how I look at it. So we should not really be terming the outcomes of the community from looking at it from a fearful perspective.
I think the outreach and connection or connectivity with people is a challenge for the EU and for ASEAN, and of course you guys will be talking about the ASEM visibility in the coming days as well. Thank you, Anita, for pointing that out. Mark, please.
Thank you. There was not really any questions directed to me, but I wanted to maybe say a few words to the gentleman who spoke about TTIP and a few reflections why there is not anything like that between Asia and Europe. Well, I think first, an historical reason. In the beginning, nobody spoke about it. We were at a time where the EU clearly had as the only priority the WTO, the Doha agreement. And the discussion on trade were basically limited to the Trade Facility Action Plan and to the Investment Facility Action Plan. Yeah. very important things, but much more modest than anything like TTIP. Afterwards, the EU chose a way, which I think is still its way. It's we want to have bilateral free trade agreements with important many partners, and still the final ambition is still to have later regional free trade agreements, like with ASEAN, maybe another time with ASEAN plus three. You know, I don't want to limit it. For the moment, we're speaking basically about ASEAN. And let me conclude, coming back to a subject, and I understand now it was a little bit sensitive that I spoke about it, the economic ministers meeting. I think one of the reasons why it didn't convene again is exactly because in 2003 we went another way, and there was no really trade discussions anymore between the EU and Asia. So there was discussions on another level, but there was not a real region to region. And therefore my idea, it could be now revived, not to speak again about trade, because this is now done in other fora, but about connectivity. It could coordinate the economical part of the connectivity at a political level. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. Orgel, please.
Well, I think the lady raised an interesting issue of the disconnection while we discuss connectivity. And, this session addresses soft connectivity. And one of the paradoxes of the time we are living through is that at this age of so much information and information technology, there is still so much disconnection about different parts of the world and cultures and people. And as we address these issues, there have been so many interesting issues that perhaps should be included in the summit discussion and the foreign minister discussion and the summit, for example, this cross-sectoral connectivity and so forth. So I just wanted to emphasize that how we manage in the future disconnection during the period of so much internet and social connection will be also an interesting topic to look into. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Orgel. Ugo, your final word.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Shad. Well, I simply conclude by recalling that the foreign ministers meeting, which will take place in Luxembourg, chaired by the High Representative Mogherini, is going to be the largest concentration of foreign ministers besides the framework of the General Assembly. I think that's a good graphic example of why ASEM is relevant, and why it is relevant as a marketplace of ideas. I quite like that definition, one could say. There was a pépinière, a nursery of ideas. And as we all know, when plants need to be nurtured, they also need some open air, that they cannot be too constrained. That's why ASEM actually has worked so far, and it has the potential to continue working. Just a word on the meeting of economy ministers. I'm not sure economy ministers would see themselves actually as connectivity as a core business. Connectivity is a broad term. We have discussed today so many aspects of the tourism, the people to people, as there were references to the recognition of diplomas in university. It's indeed a pretty broad concept that it's difficult simply to narrow down to a discussion among economy ministers, and actually they do tend to meet quite regularly also elsewhere. But if I may, since I'm the last one, thank you very much, Shada. It was a splendid occasion to discuss ASEM. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Please join me in thanking the panelists. And thank you, really, all of you for listening, asking questions and taking part. I remain convinced, and I have done that for the last 20 years. I was in Bangkok in 96, working for the Far Eastern Economic Review and being one of the first journalists to write about it. I remain convinced that this is a very relevant construct. And I thank the External Action Service, the European External Action Service, for making this organization, this conference, possible. And I thank you all for taking part in it. And I look forward to seeing you and meeting you all again in the months to come, leading up to Luxembourg and then to Ulaanbaatar. Thank you very much indeed.